Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren, and Mr. David Martino, Karate Boy, is here.
I am here. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Are you waxing on or waxing off today?
Both. Just not at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. I don't. Well, you're the pro. I'm not.
Yeah.
You're the pro. You know, I've been really getting tired of these. Have you been seeing all these zero-calorie, like these sodas? They're all flavored sodas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Diet Pops are getting, they're harder to find because, I don't know. You know,
really,
COVID and shipping and different stuff.
Oh, okay.
And they're making regular pop, and then of course all the soda places are putting these out, and it's I don't get much flavor out of any of them.
No,
I don't get it. You know, some of them sound like they're going to be great, and then you go taste it, and it's like water, and it's like it, I don't know, it tastes like an old pop that's been just sitting there.
You might as well drink bubbly water.
Yeah,
that's what I'm drinking.
Well, yeah.
I've switched from soda to water.
But you put whiskey in it.
That's later.
Oh.
No, I don't want water in my whiskey.
Oh, no water diluted? Back or whatever they call that.
Yeah, water back, you do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. a little water, a couple drops.
A little water. Well, you better get your whiskey out because we've got we got a thriller speculative author here. He's going to scare you. He's going to have you on the edge of your seat.
Absolutely.
You're going to be shaking. So you get that whiskey going. Anyway. So we've got an all-around author. He's written a couple of different categories here, but we're going to talk to him, well, about everything. So Mr. Michael Paul Kozlowski, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, so where did it all start for you? When did you start feeling this way?
Well, I always was interested in writing and stories, but I never thought it was possible. You know, everyone, to me, it felt like people wanting to be a sports player or a rock star. Everyone was like, come on, what's the chances of being an author? You know, focus on your education, get a normal 9-to-5, and that'll be the end of it. So I was like, okay. I went to school for teaching. I became a high school English teacher, and I did that for about 3 years, and it started weighing on me. I didn't feel I was a great teacher. I don't have that disposition. I don't have the, I'm not a disciplinarian and I'm a bit too loose. So, you know, I think I motivated the kids, but it was a little too chaotic for me. So I thought I was doing them a disservice. I thought I was doing myself a disservice. And if I decided I was going to write when I retired, I just would never be fulfilled. So I said, you know what? My father passed. He left me a little bit of money. And I said, I'm going to honor him by taking this money. I'm going to quit teaching and I'm going to try writing until I burn up this money living in New York City. And I'll see where I am. If nothing happens, I'll go back to teaching. So I did that for a few years. I was pumping out all different types of books, very abstract, very, you know, dense, 1,000-page novels, which of course weren't going to get published. And I was running out of time. And my wife said, why don't you try something that's a little more accessible? And I said, okay. I went to the movies. I saw the movie Coraline. I don't know if you remember that one. And I said, I could do something like that. I could do something like that. So I started writing a children's book. And I finished it. It was called Juniper Berry. And it's like a horror novel for about middle school, junior high school kids. And I finished it. And that week, I got a check in the mail from my account, closing out my account. It was my last $14. And the next week, I signed with an agent. And 2 weeks after that, I sold it, Juniper Berry, for a 2-book deal. And I've been writing ever since.
Wow. So that, that was pretty risky. It's pretty courageous, actually, because New York is expensive. So even a little bit of money, it doesn't take long to be gone.
That's true.
And not only that, so to do kind of a kid's book, in a sense, is risky too, right?
Sure. Well, you know, I was naive. I didn't go to college for this. You know, I went for education. So I wasn't sure what the right avenue was and what was accessible and what wasn't and what was marketable and what wasn't. So it was a risk to me, but I wasn't as aware of the risk as I am now.
Well, it's a bit late now.
Yeah. Right.
So I find it interesting. So under MP Kozlowski, you do these Juniper Berry and stuff like that. And then you've changed to a fuller name of using your Michael Paul rather than MP now for this new book. Is there a particular reason you did that?
Sure. I just wanted to differentiate between my children's books and my adult books. So the newest novel, Scarecrow Has a Gun, is just very adult. So I didn't want, the kids picking up that and thinking that it's like my other books. And so when I continue to write adult novels, they'll be under the Michael Paul Kozlowski. And when I continue to write the young adult and the middle grade novels, they'll be under MP Kozlowski. Originally, I did MP. I just thought it had a better ring to it, which then I, of course, ended up regretting. I said I should have just went with my full name. But now I think it's a good way to differentiate the two.
You know, I'm wondering if there was a moment when you discovered or thought you came to realization that writing was possible, as a career. I know I didn't think it was possible either until a friend of mine actually got a book deal. And then I was like, wow, somebody can actually do this. I had never met, somebody who actually had a book deal and wrote for a living or anything like that. So I'm just wondering, did you have a moment like that?
Well, I didn't know anybody who published anything. My circle was pretty small. I grew up on Long Island, so now I was in Manhattan, and I didn't really know anybody. So I was just trying to pump this out myself, and I really didn't know if it was going to work out. And like I said, I was pretty naive, but I heard stories. I saw what was getting published, and I knew I had talent, and I knew I could at least do what a lot of these people were doing. But there was nobody whose path I was following directly, no.
So what made you go into this speculative fiction kind of thriller style from the young adult?
Sure. Well, I love speculative fiction. I love adult literary works. That was what I started writing when I first set out, and I happened to fall into the children's books. But this is where my real passion is. And I have a few other books up my sleeve that I either finished recently or am finishing. And I feel like it's a better expression of who I am and the way I think. It's very existential. It's philosophical. It zeroes in on the minutia of life, the gritty details. And I'm a pretty dark person, and I feel like that's where I can express myself best. Whereas with the children's books, you want to be, you don't want to go too dark with them, although my children's books are dark. But not as gritty, I would say.
So you don't want to scare the kids as much as the adults.
That's right. Well, yes, I definitely scare them both, just in different ways.
Wow. So how do you decide, like, so here you are, here's Michael sitting at home there in New York, and he's broke, and he's going to write this book, this speculative fiction. How does it start for you? Like, does it start with the character? Does it start with the idea, the story? Something happened to you, or something you saw made you think, well, what if that happened, and like where does it all start in that mind?
For this book in particular, or
for actually for any book, or if it's similar, but if it's different, then we'll talk about that. But in this book in particular, because it's your new one, The Scarecrow Has a Gun, what was going on there?
Yeah, there's definitely always has to be a jumping point, that something that just sparks it in me. And for this book, funnily enough, I was trying to write a memoir about my childhood, which. There was some tragedy in my childhood, and it was very important to me to get it down. It was my family story. So I started writing that. And to do that, I had to interview all my brothers and my mother and everyone and get their stories. So what I realized once I started comparing notes is that we all had different memories about the same events. We were coming at it from completely different perspectives. And I said, no, wait, I thought you weren't there for that. And well, I thought this didn't happen, but this happened. And it was all different. So it started me thinking about memory a lot, which Scarecrow Has a Gun is mostly about. It's about memory and the pitfalls of it and how our lives aren't what we really think they are. So I'm writing the memoir, and I can't get this thought out of my head that basically our lives should come with a tagline based on a true story, that we live different lives than what we remember. And I said, I need to get this down. So I set the memoir aside, and I started writing this novel about a man who gets a box that can replay every memory he's ever had. And it plays them in random order, and he starts watching these memories, and they're not lining up with what he thought he remembered. And he starts wondering if it's being manipulated, if it's faked, if he starts questioning everything, because that's how I felt at that time.
Wow. So how much of yourself do you have to put into this when you do something like that? Because you're kind of going with a lot of your own memories, or how your memory works and things from your own life. How far would you go in a book like this?
My personal views, experiences, they're all over this book. They're not directly translated into the novel. There's pieces of me everywhere and inspiration and jumping off points. I believe that every writer is somewhere inside of every character, no matter how different, no matter how nice or how evil, we're in every single character. And so a lot of these memories, they're not direct memories of things I've experienced, but the essence of them and what I was struggling with, that's all in there. So it's definitely a microcosm of what was going on inside my head at that time.
So
your main character, Sean, how do you experience that character and how did you come up with that character?
Well, I needed a character. I knew I wanted to get across the issues of memory and how reliable it is and how we manipulated ourselves and molded to what we want to believe instead of what really happened. And I said, I need a character who would have greater motivation to sit through this, to sit through these memories and sift through it with a larger meaning. So what we discover about Sean is that when he was younger, he was married at a young age, and his wife was killed right before his eyes. And the problem was that sometime in the middle of that conflict, he was hit over the head and he suffered retrograde amnesia. And so he can't remember what happened to her, who killed her, why he couldn't save her. And this is what troubles him, this big blank spot, because he wants to find the killer. He wants to know the details of what happened. And so now whenever he's looking at this memory box, he's waiting for this memory to reappear. And that terrifies him more than anything. And so I use that as the device to keep him going, reliving his memories. So that's where his character came from.
Well, how was it writing about the death of a spouse? I've done that a couple of times, and I tend to get a little like superstitious about it and maybe feel like I hold back a bit. What was your experience?
Oh, yeah. My wife's always like, are people going to think that you want me dead?
Exactly.
Right. I go, no. And that's what you have to say. Well, this isn't you. That character's not me. Although there are parts of me and there's parts of her in these characters, they're not directly related. I realize that when I write, there has to be no holds barred. I get to be very, I tend to be very graphic. I tend to be, I want the truth out there as blazingly hot as possible. So I can't allow myself to have restrictions in any way, about, you know, the sensitivities of others or what people are going to think or how they're going to read into it. If it's what I really feel and if it serves the story, I have to put it in there.
So you're not censoring yourself in any way? You're not worried about any political correctness or anything?
I don't censor myself in any way, but I would be lying if I said I'm not worried about, people reading into things that aren't there and trying to find a problem when there isn't. I think a lot of people are sensitive to that nowadays, and it's pretty much unavoidable, but I can't write with that monkey on my back, constantly concerned with what they're going to think. Although, you know, once it's been written, when I'm done and I say, oh, what if somebody gets offended by this? Or what if somebody has a problem with that? And, you know, I deal with it afterwards.
So what is your kind of, process here? So do you set aside time every day and sit down and write, like, kind of, you know, 5 hours a day, 5 days a week and all this? Or do you have to kind of wait till the feeling hits you, or kind of where does it go for you and how do you create?
When I first started, I was, inspiration, when it strikes, that's when I would write. And so, sometimes I wouldn't start writing until late at night, and then I'd write into the morning. And, you know, I had a crazy schedule and just whenever it fit. But then once you get married, you have kids, you go, okay, I have to start being structured now. So in the beginning, I would work from home, obviously, and my wife would go out to work, and I would have the kids at home, and I'd only be able to write during their nap times. So I'm stressing, and I go, okay, you have to be inspired now. You have an hour and a half, get this in. And then they would go off to school, and I would write while they're at school. And then when they're home, then it's family time. And now during the summers, my whole summer is lost. There's no way I could write with the kids in the house, because I do need deep focus and deep concentration. And there's just too much chaos. So I tend to take off in the summers. And then my kids start school again tomorrow. So I plan to get back behind the keyboard tomorrow. And I'll write from the minute they leave until the minute they get back.
And do you actually experience your characters like a movie or like a sound, or do you hear voices? Like, when, kind of where does it go for you? Or are you more of a in charge and you kind of create everything and put it down?
Well, it's funny. A lot of people describe my my books as being very cinematic. And I think that's the influence that movies had on me as a kid, that I originally wanted to be a film writer and director. That was my original passion. And I think that transferred into my books, that I see it as I'm writing as a movie. So it's very cinematic. If I could film my books, I could do it easily because it's all there in my head.
Where do you see yourself going now? Like, do you plan on following this sort of speculative fiction sort of world?
Yes, I definitely have a follow-up book in the works that's a similar type of speculative fiction, where it's about a man infiltrating cults of technology, but it's more satirical. So he infiltrates a group of people that are obsessed with arcade machines, especially one in particular that they believe is killing people. Another one where they think a karaoke machine has become sentient. Another one with people worshiping sex robots. And so it's basically me trying to say how we got here today, this cult-like mentality. So it's not as much of a thriller as it is a satire. So, but it's in that speculative bent. So that's probably what's coming next. Although my children's books are speculative as well. I'm currently shopping around a poltergeist type story for a young adult book. So I'm going back and forth.
Would you say that your speculative fiction is kind of multi-genre?
Definitely.
Like a mixed?
Definitely the children's books. The adult books, I would say, if I had to classify them, they would be speculative adult literary fiction. Whereas the kids' books, they're speculative, but I have some are fantasy, some are science fiction, some are paranormal. So those are all over the place.
It's interesting. Do you find that mixing genre, does that make it more difficult to publish? You know, to get those books in print, like for the children's books?
I think it is. I think everyone wants to put authors in a box, and I never wanted to be that type of author who could only write one thing, and you know, every book cover looks similar, and you kind of know exactly what you're going to get. I like to jump all over the place, and I have a lot of interest, so I always want to write about what's interesting me at that moment.
I almost think when you're talking about memory and the failing memory, or the way people remember things different, and what we do to manipulate our own memory, and also what happens to our memory, you know, organically maybe. Mm-hmm. When you're doing all that, is that sort of a point that you want people to take away from this book?
Definitely. It's basically like, the philosopher John Locke said that there's two people inside of us. There are people who perform an act, and there are people, the person who remembers the act, because those are completely different things. That you and I could have gone to a concert in the past, and if you don't remember that concert at all, it's almost as if saying, were you even there? If I was moved by that concert and had a tremendous effect on the rest of my life, I always think back on it, it clearly affected me. I was there. But if you were there, weren't moved, totally forgot about it, we could say you were never even there, if you have no memory of it. It's kind of like also with think about when you're driving or washing dishes, showering. We almost end.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
For this animal-like state of just simply existing reflexively and instinctually, that sometimes you finish an act and you go, I don't remember anything that happened. I don't know how I got to the end of this, because your mind is somewhere else. And you know, there was an interesting case that in 1987, a Canadian man killed his mother-in-law while he was sleepwalking. He bludgeoned her with a tire iron, and he ended up being acquitted because the judge deemed him to be a different person when he was awake than when he was sleepwalking. And if we were to punish him, which if you put him in prison, you know, part of the goal of prison is justice. And then the other two are it's a deterrent and it's a rehabilitation. But if he has no memory of doing this, and when he's awake, he's a good person and means well and wants to do good things, how is he being rehabilitated? How is he learning his lesson if he doesn't even remember doing it? So there's all these complications with memory is about, you know, does it make us who we are? And these are all things that I'm grappling with.
Interesting. Did you find writing this book helped you with your traumatic memories of the past?
You know, I think it did. And I think almost the entire message of the book is basically saying we can't trust our past. What it teaches me is that all we could really believe in, because we don't know what's going to come in the future, is the present, the immediate present. And we have to soak that up and enjoy that moment, because the past is fiction. Our who we are fiction. The only thing that is true is in the moment. And I think that's what I took from the book. And I think that's what other people hopefully will take from the book.
So after this interview, well, we exist.
That's right.
No.
Well, you know, I think we'll all have different versions of how this interview went. And that's it's kind of like rewriting history. Even history books, I think, there are facts in there. But once you start going into details about those facts, everything changes, and people could have different interpretations and different memories about these events, and it changes history. So you'll go on and you'll have one type of history, and I'll have another, and you try to make the best with it.
Wow. So how do we know what really happened anywhere?
Exactly. And that's the great struggle. And once you realize that, then you go, you know what? Why worry about it? I'm going to live in the moment and enjoy this moment, because this is what's real. This is what's true.
Okay. Well, I'm going home.
Well, for example, in the book, Sean comes across a memory of when his son was born, and he's like, "Oh, this is a wonderful memory. One of the best memories of my life." And he sees in the memory that he arrives into the hospital room seconds after his child was born, and he says, "No, I was there. I held him. I remember this, and this is such an important moment." But the screen is showing him something else. And he's like, wait a minute. And he starts questioning it. Did I come in after? I thought I cut the cord. Did I cut the cord? Or is that my other kid? And he starts questioning all these things. Because if you tell a story enough, you start to believe it, even if it's not true. And to me, something like that, which is in all our pasts, a major event might not have gone down exactly as we experienced it. And to me, that's scary.
Seems very zen.
Yes.
Oh, it does, yes. Right? Present moment.
When you do something like this, how far can you go with some of these ideas in a sense? Like, where do you really know? Because everyone's looking for an answer, right? And how do you do a book that's a thriller? Everybody wants a happy ending, especially in fiction, or at least a resolve of some sort. So how do you achieve that when we don't really know what's happened?
Well, right. Well, which in this book, it all depends if you believe what he sees on the screen is the actual truth. If such a machine existed that without a doubt showed us exactly how we lived our lives, then that would be the truth. So if he sees all these memories, realizes what his life was really like, and accepts that as the truth, then he could use that knowledge and change his present and his future. So does he find out who killed his wife? Does he find out what his relationship with his kids is really like? And if he doesn't like what he sees, can he fix it? So there is, in this book in particular, a way out to have a happy ending.
With the false memory motif, how do you keep track of everything in the story? Do you have a method for doing that? Do you use note cards? Do you have a computer program? Or how do you stay organized?
Everything goes in a notebook that I have next to me at all times. I'm not one to blot in crazy detail. I always have my beginning and end. I have the major scenes that I want to get across, but everything else in between tends to come as I'm writing, and I go, oh, this would be a great place to take the character, or this will be an exciting scene to put in. And then once I get that, I always jot down in my notebook what happened, what took place. So then I could always go back and reference it and say, oh, wait, he had this memory. This will affect this later on. So I tend to edit as I go as well. So it all meshes together pretty well for me.
Well, how do you know you wrote the notebooks? maybe your memory was not right. Maybe someone else wrote that.
There you go. So many times I'll come across old notebooks of mine and I'll look at story ideas or just lines that I wrote down and I'll stare at it for minutes going, I don't remember this in the slightest. And it's a little scary. And, I have old journals and diaries and I haven't even opened those up because I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to find. And there's going to be things that I remember that I don't want to remember. Because whenever I tend to write in my journals, I tended to be in a depressed state when I wrote those. And you know, if I forgot those, then maybe that's better. And that's another thing is that with memory, there's so many negatives that happen to us that we forget about, that in order to move on, you shut them away. And opening that up, you're going to see, oh, one time when I was in school, I was horrible to that kid. I said this comment and I bullied this kid. And I don't remember those details right now. And I don't want to, because if I do, it's gonna wreck me. And, you know, there's pluses and minuses.
So I always ask this of a lot of the speculative fiction authors. What's your definition of speculative fiction?
Oh, that's a good question. Because I think my definition would be when you take reality and you bend it a little bit to get your story across. So my Scarecrow as a Gun is very realistic, but it has the slightest hint of sci-fi, which is the box that could read your memories. And I mean, there are some other very small elements that are mentioned toward the end of the book, but otherwise that's the speculative bent. It's just that one piece. Otherwise it's all realistic.
How do you draw that line? Like, it's interesting to me to, you know, so you have life as it is, and it's fairly modern day, and everything's real except for, let's say, that box. Mm-hmm. And do you throw in some other things too, like a dinosaur or something? Or
well, you know, I no dinosaurs, but I do like to do. There are some type of psychedelic parts, I guess you could call it, toward the end of the book, where you don't know what's real and what isn't, where his mind is really flayed and destroyed, and it's almost like he's hallucinating, and in reality he doesn't know what's real and what's not anymore. Forget about watching his memories in the screen, his real life becomes blurred. So I think it just makes it more interesting to me in the types of books I want to read and write. When if you don't want to do the full jump into hard genre, hard science fiction or fantasy, but you want it mixed in, you don't want everyday life as it is either, speculative fiction is probably best. I definitely find it most enjoyable.
I've got to think that going through the process of putting together this book with so much thought toward memory and some of your memories and then other people's and the way your characters go through all this tragedy and stuff, in a sense, with all of that at the end of it, when you finally get it kind of finished to be published, I've got to think that that plays a toll on you as well. It's got to have changed you somewhat in the way you look at your own life.
Well, it definitely does. And the thing that makes me feel good is that a lot of people who have read the book, whether I know them personally or I see reviews online, whether they liked it or not, they all come away saying it made me question things. It made me look at my own memories, at my own past. And that's all I could hope to do as an author. And because now you're on my playing field, which is, this is how I feel all the time. I'm constantly questioning and constantly trying to look at the bigger picture. And this book, you know, it's something, memory was something I've always grappled with. But when you dive this deep into it, it just, it expands it even more. So now there's nothing I could do where I'm not relating it to some type of theme from the book, some type of memory, and I'm always making jokes to my wife, and is this real and is this not? Did that really happen? So yeah, it's in my day to day from now on.
Wow. What do you think for yourself when you pick up a book and you read it? What makes a good, let's say, speculative fiction or science fiction or anything like that? What makes a good book for you?
Definitely, I need the writing to be elevated. That's important to me. I want to be moved by the language. One of my favorite authors is like Don DeLillo, Jennifer Egan, I like a lot. Authors like that have a gift with language. To me, that's the first thing that has to stick out. And then after
Dave,
that,
Dave Martino in there too, or you're supposed to say yes.
Yeah, right.
It's okay.
No, but I'll be glad to check Dave out. Yeah, definitely. Language, and then after that, it's making me see something in life that I haven't already noticed, or if I have noticed it, making me see it in a different way. I don't like as much light reading. I like to really be immersed.
So, do you think that older science fiction and that sort of genre compared to modern day science fiction? Because I say that because nowadays, it's speculative fiction. There's all these different versions. We have mm-hmm. so many different mini genres, you know, that back in the old day, it was just science fiction or horror, you know, like right. there wasn't the classification. But do you like older stories better, like some of the classics? Or do you think modern day writers are doing a pretty good job?
You know, I go back and forth. I don't just read modern authors. I do like to go back and, like Philip K. Dick was one of my favorites. I read every single Vonnegut. Stephen King, I read a lot of. So I do like, I mean, and I guess you could go farther back than that and go, you know, H.G. Wells and Lovecraft. So, to me, I mean, they're just as good as modern authors, if not better. So I could go anywhere on the spectrum.
Yeah. It was just that being a teacher. When you were teaching, do you find that students or younger people today or nowadays, do you think that they're as good a writers or as good at language, let's say, or scripting, let's say, as people, let's say, even 20, 30 years ago?
Well, it's hard to say because I haven't taught in 20 years, but from my experience when I was teaching, like it's always been, there are kids who are completely turned off and don't want to learn or don't want to read or don't want to write. And then there are the kids who you could tell they cling to it and this is for them, and they really thrive with it. And I think that that's the story of how things were, 50 years ago, and that's how it's going to be 50 years from now. I think there are always going to be people who are passionate about it and people who couldn't care less.
Did you take anything from your teaching career into your writing, whether it's how you approach writing or through, maybe your process?
Sure. I the thing that helped me the most was teaching the classics over and over and over again. Hmm. Because every time you read it and you're talking to the kids about it, you're picking up something new. And, most of us, when we read a book, we'll read it once and move on and never read it again. And when you study something over and over again, you start to see how they did it. You start to understand why it's so great on the smallest of levels. And I think that really helped with my writing. Because, if I'm doing Gatsby or Great Expectations or Lord of the Flies, Catch on the Right, whatever, I would have read those only once. But now I had to go back to them. And I was teaching it five periods a day. And I just got such a renewed appreciation for it. And it really left its mark on me.
Well, hopefully it healed.
No, that's one I don't want to heal,
Well, and so when you're writing young adult fiction and things like that, what would be the biggest difference between writing that as compared to something like Scarecrow?
What I noticed is when I write children's books, I always want to relate it to something that's going on today or something that people have to deal with. And I noticed with my children's books, it's on a much broader scale. Like Rose Coffin was a metaphor for the suppression of women's voices and about trying to find a purpose in life. So these are broad topics that I would tackle in my children's books. But with my adult books, I zero in on something. So memory, I just take it and I go all the way down with the microscope as far as it can go, and I analyze every aspect of it. So it's not as broad. I noticed that's the difference. With the kids' books, I tackle big topics in a broad way, and with the adult books, I do it on a very surface, under the heaviest of microscopes.
Well, so let's see. Now, are you doing social media? Or are you interactive with readers and people, or do you have a website? How do people find you?
I do. I have a website, mpkozlowski.com. I am on Twitter and Instagram, mpkozlowski, at mpkozlowski. Sometimes I always get emails through my website from, people who read my children's books 10 years ago, and they're still writing to me about it. And it's such a great thing to receive and to read these emails, how much I touch them. And I hope, people continue to write to me, to contact me on Twitter. So I'm just now starting to build my adult audience. So I don't know if they'll be sending me emails, but hopefully, they connect through Instagram or Twitter. That'd be cool.
Yeah, they do. They're just a little bit meaner, but
right.
They're still there. Of course, we'll have your website up on ours as well, so people can find you easily. One click, and stuff. Wow. So, are you going to do a sequel to this memory, or are you just going to kind of carry on from after your after?
Yeah, no. Scarecrow is a one and done, so that one's all finished. I'm already moving on to the next things.
Okay, well, that's it. It's always good to know. And well, fantastic. It's been interesting. We have your book, everything up, so people can find you. And did the COVID interfere with your sort of writing any, like emotionally or stressful? Or
it was stressful because my kids were home, and I was like, they were learning on their laptops, and I had to basically be a second teacher in the classroom. So I was very stressed. I lost a lot of writing, and again, I had to adjust and try to find a new way to get my ideas down. And I started handwriting a book on pads, and that's the thing. Once you become a parent, you have to be a lot more creative in finding time and ways to do what you need to.
Yeah. It's kind of what goes on.
Right.
Yeah. Anybody you want to work with?
No one in particular, but I would love to, be involved in like anthologies or, I'm always looking for opportunities. So if anybody's out there looking for a writer, please hit me up. I'd love to get more of my work out there.
Well, fantastic. Well, again, I appreciate you being on the show. And the book we're talking about is your new one called Scarecrow Has a Gun. And that's Michael Kozlowski. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Michael.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.